Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Tom Campbell, visiting professor of economics and law at Chapman University, former dean of the Haas School of Business at Berkeley, former member of the Joint Economic Committee of the United States Congress, and former director of California's Department of Finance. I'll be your moderator today. Today's program is part of the Charles and Louise Travers series on ethics and accountability. It's being held in association with the Shorenstein Program in Politics, Policy, and Values at the University of California at Berkeley. We want to thank the Concord Coalition and its members for their help in making this program possible. And we welcome our listeners on radio, television, and the internet. And we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight, we'll focus on a subject that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff recently referred to as the number one national security issue, the growing U.S. national debt. The national debt is the accumulated debt that the government owes from years of borrowing money to pay off the annual deficits. It's currently estimated at $13 trillion. The U.S. annual deficit is the amount by which that debt grows every year. This year, it's estimated to grow by $1.3 trillion. Federal spending has averaged about 21% of the gross domestic product over the past 40 years, while revenues have averaged about 18% over that same time. The resulting deficits have thus been about 3% of the GDP, year in and year out. Spending on entitlements, primarily for automatic increases in health care and retirement benefits, is projected to grow even faster than revenues and the economy over the coming decades. This leads to a gap of more than that 3% of GDP every year, a gap that has to be filled by borrowing. Eventually, this growing debt burden will simply become impossible to finance. The Concord Coalition, a national nonpartisan organization advocating fiscal responsibility, projects the United States national debt to rise to more than $15 trillion over the next decade. Numerous experts say that the largest components of this projected spending growth are the three largest and most popular entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. The financial crush of these three programs all but eliminates the possibility of responsible policymaking for any other government spending. The challenge for politicians of both parties is to debate fiscal issues on transparent and substantive grounds. Public engagement and understanding is also vital to finding solutions. Our speakers today say that this problem is not one about numbers, but it is truly a moral issue. To discuss the hard choices that have to be made and what lies ahead if they're not, I'm now pleased to introduce today's distinguished panelists. David Walker served for a decade as Comptroller General of the United States. He also headed the United States Government Accountability Office. His term began during the administration of President Clinton and continued through that of President George W. Bush. Currently, Mr. Walker is President and CEO of the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, whose mission is to increase public awareness of the nature and urgency of key economic challenges that threaten America's future. Mr. Walker is also chairman of the United Nations Independent Audit Advisory Committee and a member of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board's Advisory Committee. Mr. Walker is a certified public accountant. He also has a certificate in senior management in government from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Dr. Michael J. Boskin is professor of economics at Stanford University and a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He served as chairman of President's Council of Economic Advisors under President George H.W. Bush. The Independent Council for Excellence in Government rated Dr. Boskin's Council of Economic Advisors as one of the five most respected agencies out of more than 100 in the federal government. Dr. Boskin is the author of more than 150 books and articles. He's an advisor to governments and global businesses. He's internationally recognized for his research in economic and other issues of public policy. He writes regularly for the Wall Street Journal opinion page and has a bi-monthly column on global economics, which is syndicated in 145 countries. He holds a PhD in economics from the University of California at Berkeley. I said 145 countries. I think I meant 145 publications.
No, countries.
Countries. Oh, it's even more impressive. Dr. Isabel Sawhill, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution. Dr. Sawhill is a nationally known budget expert and is currently director of the Brookings Project for Budgeting for National Priorities. Dr. Sawhill served as Associate Director of the Office of Management and Budget during the administration of President Clinton and has been Director of the National Commission for Employment Policy, as well as President of the Association for Public Policy Analysis and Management. She's also been a visiting professor at Georgetown University Law School. Dr. Sawhill holds a PhD in economics from New York University. Robert L. Bixby is Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. The Concord Coalition was founded in 1992 by former U.S. Senators Warren Rudman and Paul Tsongas. Former Senator Bob Kerrey now serves as co-chair of the organization. The Concord Coalition is a national nonpartisan organization that mobilizes grassroots support for fiscally responsible federal budget policy. Mr. Bixby has been with the coalition since its founding in 1992, having served in the past as policy director and national field director. Prior to joining the Concord Coalition, Mr. Bixby practiced law and also served as chief staff attorney of the Court of Appeals of Virginia. Mr. Bixby holds a Juris Doctorate from George Mason University School of Law and a master's degree in public administration from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Our opening question is to describe the facts of this problem. And I'd like to turn to David Walker to begin and then ask our other panelists to participate as they might wish. Mr. Walker.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be back at the Commonwealth Club. First, while Americans are very concerned about today's deficits and debt, $1.4 trillion, $13.4 trillion respectively, they really don't represent the threat to America's future. The threat to America's future are the deficits and debt levels that will occur in the future because of known demographic trends, rising health care costs, and a growing gap between revenues and expenses. Today's deficits are largely temporary. They're due to a weak economy. They're due to temporary tax cuts. They're due to two wars that are undeclared and unfinanced. They're due to a range of unprecedented bailout and stimulus programs. These things will pass over time. But the structural deficits, the ones that exist because of the things that I mentioned before, they represent the threat to the ship of state. You can't grow your way out. It would take double-digit real GDP growth for decades. You can't inflate your way out because most of the problem are off-balance sheet obligations, unfunded Medicare and Social Security and other obligations. You can't tax your way out because you'd have to double taxes over time in order to be able to deal with it. And you can't cut your way out solely because you'd have to decimate social insurance programs, which are important for a safety net for this program. So everything has to be on the table. Couple of final points. For the second time in the history of the United States, we have over 60% of debt to GDP. The only other time that we've ever had it was World War II. And that doesn't count the several trillion dollars that we owe to Social Security and Medicare. If you counted that, we're at 91% of GDP. Furthermore, if you do honest accounting, federal, state, and local debt held by the public as a percentage of the economy, we're already worse than Spain. We're already worse than Portugal. We're already worse than Ireland. We're already worse than the United Kingdom. We're within 10 years of being where Greece is. And if you count what we owe Social Security and Medicare, we're within 3 years of Greece.
Michael Boskin, it's hard to believe that David Walker missed anything, but is there anything you could add to it?
Let me add a bit of flavor. I certainly agree the long-run fiscal crisis is severe and one of the two or three greatest issues confronting the United States, and because it's confronting the United States, the global economy. There are others, nuclear proliferation, Iran, and North Korea, and so on, that I'd put pretty high on the list, too. But I think we need to take a little bit of step back from what David had to say. First of all, there is a real serious intermediate-term deficit and debt crisis. He said, well, don't worry about the short term. I personally think he's partly right. I think part of the short term has been deficit and debt has been aggravated by very ineffective programs designed to try to deal with the economy. Perhaps they were well-intentioned, but they seem to have been, and most studies suggest they're pretty ineffective. But most importantly, he's very sanguine about all this stuff disappearing later, that it's just the long term. There's very little evidence. We keep seeing more and more stuff piled on, attempts to try to make more and more of it permanent or extended, et cetera. And so I'm very, very concerned that the spending will get entrenched. I think it's very important not just to deal with the long-term deficit and problem and debt problem, but to deal with the intermediate-term problem quickly so we're on a path over the next 2, 3, 4 years, 5 years, not just 20, 30 years to deal with the long-run problem, but deal with the intermediate problem to get us back to a sensible fiscal position. I think it undermines a lot of things in our country. Right now, it is being the seriousness of it is being masked by the fact people are willing to hold lots of dollar treasury bonds at very low interest rates because of the great uncertainty in our financial system and so on. But we are financing our debt unprecedentedly at the short end of the market. When interest rates rise and people want higher yields, we'll have to go longer term and interest costs will explode. So we have a lot of problems that I think are embedded in the spending programs and other programs that have been promulgated in the last several years, and not just by the current administration but by previous ones. And those, I think, have to be unwound as well in the intermediate term, or we'll wind up further into the baby boom's retirement that David's referring to, with a lot more problems already on our doorstep besides having to deal with future problems. I'd also make a couple of other points, these last 2 points. One is it should not be a matter of indifference to us how we close this gap. If it was done overwhelmingly on the tax side, the probability is very close to one that would do immense harm to our economy. We have responsibilities on the spending side. We need an effective government to be a successful society, from defense to a sensible safety net, et cetera. But it is important that we keep the tax burden in our society as low as we can, consistent with funding the necessary functions of government and restructuring programs that are not targeted well and not effective enough to make them more effective, more cost-conscious, and to enable us to afford the demographic surge is going to occur. So that's the first point. The second point is that until we make some of these changes, it will be very, very difficult to deal with some of those cost changes, especially the medical cost. In the current system, there's very little incentive to economize. There are many reasons for that. Some of it's government policy. Some of it is the way Medicare is funded, some of it's third-party reimbursement, that people have very little skin in the game at the margin for their non-emergency, non-catastrophic services and have little incentive to economize. If we don't make some sensible changes, President Obama's got his set in there. I personally think that they're not very good. I would much prefer to replace many of them with things that I think would be better. But the fact of the matter is, unless we do that, the arithmetic will be even worse. So I think it's important that we not just think of it as an accounting exercise, as important as that is to give us a sense that the overall problem is tremendously large, because otherwise we'll neglect the fact that we're going to do things that affect the economy and could harm the economy.
Michael, just one quick follow-up. The expansion of Medicare for pharmaceutical under the previous administration would certainly be one of those open-ended additions, would it not? I don't mean to put you on the spot.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I think it should have been much more carefully focused on need and on catastrophic coverage and not on just on general. But I think in the modern day and age, as typical, the government sets something up over a long time. People substitute away from it. So more and more medical coverage became pharmaceuticals rather than things that Medicare covered. Just as when we tighten down the budget, the Congress figures out ways to do things off the budget, which is a large part of how the housing crisis got developed through Fannie and Freddie and the social engineering of housing that wasn't done through the budget process.
I brought that up to at least make an initial sortie into bipartisanship, that there's plenty of blame to go around.
Fair enough.
Bell, is it a problem that we observe now? Is it something that's got long-term, or is it immediate as well?
Well, I think there's something to be said on all fronts. In other words, let's talk about history, and then let's talk about the current situation, and let's talk about David's long-term. I think on the history, it's very clear that we've had many years of irresponsible fiscal policy. As has already been said, we financed 2 wars and the prescription drug benefit that you just mentioned, just put them on the national credit card, didn't make any effort to pay for them. We had surpluses at the end of the Clinton administration. They had evaporated very soon after the Bush administration came into office, and we had very large tax cuts. If you look at how we went from a surplus in 2000 to the 1.3 or 1.4 level deficit we have right now, About 40% of it, the analysis shows, was due to things that happened on Bush's watch. About 20% is due to the current recession. And then another chunk is due to about 16% is due to Obama's policies, and another chunk is due to some technical factors we don't need to get into. So there's plenty of blame to go around for all kinds of recent administrations. On the current situation, I agree with Michael that once a spending program is in place or once a tax cut is in place, it's very hard to reverse it. So they do tend to linger beyond their current life. Many of these tax cuts that Bush passed are supposed to expire at the end of this year, but nobody believes that they aren't going to be extended. Similarly, some of the spending programs that were part of the recovery package are expected to possibly be extended as well. But I don't agree with Michael when he suggests that they haven't been ineffective. I believe that during a deep recession like we have now, you do need to reduce taxes and increase spending, and deficits are not bad. And there is a good analysis that's been done by Alan Blinder, former Fed vice chair, who found that 8.5 million jobs had been created by a combination of the financial bailout and the Recovery Act.
And almost none of it was due to the fiscal stimulus, according to Alan.
We will come right back to this. You can believe that.
Agree with David that the big problem is long-term and that it's driven by rising health care costs and the aging of the population. And I note, looking around the room as well as up here, that none of us is terribly young anymore.
My eyesight is such that we all look quite young. Bob, I thought we had a surplus in Social Security and Medicare funds. So why is there a problem here?
Well, that gets into the long-term, short-term issue as well. But in Social Security, it's when people talk about a surplus in Social Security, it is true that the Social Security Trust Fund is in surplus and will remain solvent through latest projections through 2037. So it's logical to ask, why are we even talking about that? Is that not in good shape? If you look, though, the trust fund is basically a matter of governmental accounting, one branch of the government owing another branch of the government money. The reason that we need to worry about the, or at least have it on the table, is that Social Security right now is running about even in terms of money coming in through the payroll tax and benefits going out. It'll run a small deficit this year on a cash basis and probably go into surplus again for another year or two. But basically, we're hitting the tipping point now where the payroll tax is not sufficient to pay the benefits going out. And as the boomers qualify and people begin to live longer, that gap will grow bigger and bigger as we go out. So if you look at, and I think the best way to look at it is from a budgetary standpoint, is the growing cost and how we're going to finance that. Now, the trust fund comes in because it's basically a claim that the Social Security system has on future general revenues. So one way to think about it is that, you know, if I'm the Social Security commissioner and I've got people coming in looking for benefits, and let's say the payroll tax is not sufficient, but I've got these bonds in the trust fund. So I can then take them to, let's say Dave is the Treasury Secretary, and I can take them to Dave and say, pay up. And he will do so because those bonds will be honored. But then the Treasury Secretary is going to have to figure out where to get the cash that he's just paid me for the Social Security benefits. And that's going to engender, you know, other borrowing or raising taxes or cutting other programs in order to do it. So from a budgetary standpoint, we really need to look at, and really from an economic standpoint, we need to look at the growing cost of both Social Security and Medicare. And, of course, Medicare is a much bigger problem over the long term because it's not just affected by demographics, but as Bell said, demographics and rising health care costs. And so the further out you go, the more that rising health care cost becomes more of a problem for Medicare. Another thing to note about Medicare, so just on Social Security, not as big a problem as Medicare. It's not in crisis at the moment, but the reason that we talk about it now is that if you're talking about a sustainable long-term budget, you have to figure out you know, how we're going to pay for the long-term cost of Social Security. It's not a problem if you're looking at the five-year budget outlook, and one of the problems about focusing too heavily on the short-term budget outlook is that you don't have to look at really what the long-term structural deficit is. You don't need to look at Social Security at all if you're looking at the five-year budget. Another point to make about Medicare. Often we focus, too often, almost always we focus on the Medicare Part A trust fund. Whenever the trustees report comes out, people say, well, Medicare Part A trust fund has another, you know, several years of solvency or lost a few years of solvency. It's important to remember that Medicare has Part B as well, Part B and Part D, the prescription drug benefit. And those are heavily subsidized by general revenues. They're intended to be. I mean, that's the way they function. The Part B trust fund has an open pipeline to the Treasury, so nobody ever worries about its solvency because it's automatically solvent. But from a budgetary standpoint, again, Part B and Part D are hugely expensive, particularly over the long term. So that's the reason why, even though we're talking about a surplus in those programs, they are trust fund surpluses, not budgetary surpluses.
Thank you for a very thoughtful and complete answer. It's important, I think, just to put it in simple terms, there is nothing in the trust fund that you and I would consider as an asset. It's an IOU, and as I understand it, it's not even an IOU that I can sell to a third party. It's not negotiable.
They're a special issue.
Well, I used to be a trustee of Social Security and Medicare, and basically it's an accounting device.
Yeah.
It is an IOU. It's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. It's guaranteed as to principal and interest. It will be honored, but you can't sell it to anybody. It has no real marketable value. Basically what happens is when you give it to the Treasury Secretary, he's going to go to the Chinese, the Japanese, or OPEC nations, or maybe somebody else to borrow the money. Yeah. I mean, that's basically what happens.
I want to address the next question to the two economists on the panel, professional economists, Michael and Bill. Why haven't we seen the immediate pathologies? I would think that this huge amount of debt would cause people to worry about eventual inflation, and that would cause the inflationary expectations to go up, which drives up inflation itself, and you'd expect interest rates to be going up. It seems as though the deficit grows, the debt grows as deficit, and no negatives appear. Why?
You want to start? Let me take a first crack, and I'm sure Michael will have more to say. I think on the supply side, there's a lot of money flowing into the U.S., into very safe assets, and Treasury securities are a very safe asset. The whole world is in trouble now, and so there's a sort of excess of savings that needs to go someplace, and this is a very safe place to park your money. On the demand side, because the economy is so depressed right now, there aren't a lot of businesses or other people, consumers, trying to borrow a lot of money, and therefore interest rates have stayed very low. Normally what you'd expect with the government competing with the private sector for funds is that interest rates would go up quite sharply and crowd out the ability of businesses to invest. So that's one answer.
So supply of money is moving out at least as fast as demand for money.
Well, the supply of money is coming in from abroad.
I meant by moving out, the supply curve moving out, but
yes.
Yeah. Okay, very well. Michael.
Everybody, including Ben Bernanke's, thinking about long-term inflation, but the economy and the global economy is still quite weak. Mm-hmm. So in that environment, this is much more that the weak economy is driving the deficits and debt rather than they are affecting the economy short-term. For example, the automatic reduction in tax revenues and the automatic increase in unemployment benefits, not the extensive expansions, but the automatic increases, were twice as large as the fiscal stimulus, as the discretionary fiscal stimulus. Nobody talks about them, but they were twice as large. People had automatic reductions in their taxes, et cetera. So that's number one. Number two, the dollar is the global reserve currency for the time being. That is a very beneficial thing for the United States in many ways that are too technical to go into here. but we're at risk of people deciding they need to have a broader basket of currencies become the global reserve currency, as has been suggested by heads of central banks and finance ministers and presidents of other countries who are getting increasingly concerned and are lecturing the United States, which is a little embarrassing for the United States. Usually we're lecturing other countries to quit being so profligate, and other countries are hectoring and lecturing us because they've become large holders of dollar securities, heavily treasuries, but not just treasuries, and they're very, very concerned that future inflation will erode the value. Now, given the weak global economy, that inflation's out there as a ways. Inflation's very low. Matter of fact, the Fed just issued a statement that it's slightly below where they'd actually like it to be. So I think that it isn't a short-run problem, but it is a serious problem. And in the past, moving to withdraw this massive excess liquidity that the Fed has injected has been a move that's beguiled the Fed when it's needed to start tightening. And if that happens, then we could see inflation risk come quickly, but nobody expects them in the very short term.
Did the crisis in the euro actually give a short-term reprieve from the natural tendency to doubt the dollar?
Well, people only have a certain number of places they can go. I mean, you ask, why is gold so high?
Yeah,
people around the world have decided that that's safe. They also know that in times of really horrible global disruption, like a war, that it's been an effective means of payment, so they've been willing to go into gold.
It just seemed to me
so there's just not a lot of places you can go. If you think the United States has problems, while David laid out some issues comparing us to other countries, our long-term demography is challenging. We're going from one retiree for every 3 1/4 workers to one retiree for two retire one to two rather than 1 to 3 1/4. The Europeans, the Italians, the Germans are close to 1 to 1 now, as are the Japanese. And so that's going to be a very, very much more difficult thing for them, although our health care costs are growing more rapidly than theirs.
Thanks. David?
Just
David Walker.
Quickly, I think the bottom line is a weak global economy and the United States is a temporary flight to safety, at least in the short term. At the same point in time, if we don't end up getting our fiscal house in order and if we're not able to ultimately make the turn on monetary policy, then when the economy does recover – and when demand for capital goes up in the private sector, then interest rates will go up. And to give you a sense, I'm doing my retirement planning right now. And while I'm not concerned about inflation in the short term, I'm very concerned about what it might be over time if we don't get our act together.
Let's turn to the question of, do we really need to act now? And allowing me to be a little bit provocative and not necessarily saying what I really believe. How about the following? For heaven's sakes, it begins, for heaven's sakes, we're in the worst recession since the Great Depression. Whatever the long-term problems are, let's get through this first. What's wrong with that advice?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. We're in a weak recovery, not a recession. Times aren't good.
It makes all the difference to me to hear you describe it that way.
Well, times aren't good, but there's a big difference, actually. There's a big difference in the operation of policy. So it's a slow recovery. It's painfully slow. It's much slower than the recoveries from the previous two deep recessions. It's less than half speed of that. So we've got a weak economy. It's likely to be weak for the next year.
Pushing my point, though, so it is a weak recovery. Is it the right time, or shouldn't we do everything we can, get robust recovery, and then deal with this? That's the question.
Tom, I think that
Bob Bixby, Concord
Coalition.
I think
that it is, again, important to distinguish short-term and long-term objectives here. I think it's possible to do both at once. I mean, I think you can be cognizant of the weak recovery, which we're now in, at the same time be cognizant of the deficits that are projected for the future, so that, you know, a rational policy, I think, would be to continue to allow for, I don't want to say more stimulus, but I mean, I don't think you need to start a draconian deficit reduction regime immediately. I think you can, you know, have some flexibility there. But the things that would address the long-term structural deficit, you can enact things like that now that would be phased in. I mean, nobody's going to be cutting Social Security benefits right now. You could phase it in. So, and Medicare changes would have to take a long time. Same thing is true with tax reform.
You said cutting Social Security benefits. You meant capping the rate of growth of Social Security benefits, or am I putting words in your mouth?
I think you can phrase it any way you want to. slowing the growth from current projections.
I actually Bell think that's an important distinction that you just made, Tom. I don't think anyone is talking about cutting Social Security benefits from where they are now, and nor are they talking about doing anything immediately. They're talking about slowing the growth of benefits out in the future, probably in a way that would not affect anybody who is now over 55 years of age, and probably mostly for those who are most affluent.
Okay. Well, and also not talking about privatizing Social Security either, because Social Security is a very important foundation of our retirement income security for lots of reasons. It needs to save primarily a defined benefit program. We need to make it solvent, sustainable, secure, more savings-oriented. But we do need to get our savings rate up, so we may need to have some type of automatic savings vehicle on top.
That was David Walker. Now Mike Boskin.
Let me add a couple of points. I agree with what David just said. Secondly, but two quick points. Number one, it would be a good thing if we made serious structural reforms that had the effect of exempting people who are at retirement or close to retirement, and also were structured so they gradually became more forceful as you move through time, so that 20, 30, 40 years from now, they would slow the growth a lot from projections, but do not a lot in the very short term, so they wouldn't have a big effect on people close to retirement. That, I think, everybody sort of agrees makes sense. The problem is agreeing on what those are and enacting them now in advance. It used to be we had these discussions and someone said, we better do this before the baby boom retires, but the first baby boomer's already collected Social Security. It's really important to have two facts in your head. Because for the long term, number one, for Social Security, 55% of the increases in outlays in Social Security are due to rising real benefits per beneficiary, 45% to demography, to having more retirees per worker. In Medicare, it's quite a bit more the demography and the interaction of demography and the fact that elderly people consume more health care. It's more like 75-25. So it is possible to entirely eliminate, just mathematically, difficult to do politically, entirely eliminate the Social Security deficit without decreasing anybody's real benefits one dime.
Let us, Bob, you had a comment.
Well, I just want to say on that, make a point on building on what Michael said, is that it makes it easier to have a short-term policy that accommodates a deficit if you have a long-term policy that reins in the structural deficit.
Well said.
Come back to this last issue, though.
A moment. I have to do an announcement or they will not pay me. Since they're not paying me, it's probably not much of a threat.
Double or nothing.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today's subject is the federal budget deficit, ramifications and solutions. Our panelists are David Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States, Isabel Sawhill, Senior Fellow at Brookings Institution, Michael Boskin, Stanford University Economics Professor and Hoover Institution Senior Fellow, and Robert Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. I'm Tom Campbell, Visiting Professor of Economics and Law at Chapman University and former Dean of the High School of Business at UC Berkeley, the moderator for the program. Michael Boskin.
Yeah, let me just come back to the same distinction I made at the beginning. You ought to think in three time frames, not two. This 30, 40, 50 year out there Medicare and a temporary large deficit during a recession, which we'd all agree at least the automatic part isn't a big deal. If there's an additional discretionary part, at least ought to be well designed. And I think this one was very poorly designed, but that's all another story. The key point is we have this very large growth of the intermediate term deficit and debt. We're moving into well before we start getting to Social Security and Medicare being an issue, we're getting the levels of the national debt to GDP, that ratio, which historically have caused financial crises or sharp slowdowns in growth, have been difficult to get out of. So we're adding an intermediate layer this next 10 years to this longer term stuff. So I think to be credible about the long term, you really have to address this medium term. No one's going to believe you that you put in some law that's going to take effect 30 or 40 years from now that a future Congress can change when we've just had this health care reform. The one serious cost control won't take effect, if ever, till 2018, which was the tax on Cadillac plans. And then you do nothing about the medium term deficit. I think that's just a total non-starter to anybody to be believable.
From a practical standpoint.
Bob Bixby. I'm sorry. David Walker next.
I'm sorry.
My fault.
From a practical standpoint, you don't want to do anything that's going to cause a double-dip recession. We need to do things to get unemployment down. At the same point in time, we need to be able to take steps on both fronts, short-term and medium-longer-term. And what we ought to be doing in 2011 is reimposing tough statutory budget controls, pay-as-you-go rules that don't have trillions of dollars of exemptions that will be effective immediately, statutory spending caps that will take effect once unemployment gets to a stated level. We need to reform Social Security to make it solvent, sustainable, secure, more savings-oriented, not because it's immediate prices, not because it's the biggest problem. It's the biggest opportunity. And we need to start rebaselining government to make it future-focused and results-oriented. It's going to take us 10 to 20 years to do that. But we need to get started in 2011.
Let's move into the practical. I'm just going to introduce the subject, then I'll recognize Bill on this. Let's talk now about specific solutions. We know that there is a commission, the Alan Simpson Erskine Bowles commission that President Obama appointed. They are going to come up with a series of recommendations in December. I'd like to ask you, Bill Sohail, and then other panelists, what should that commission be recommending? I want specifics, and I will note in introducing this subject that the original idea was that the commission would be able to bring a set of suggestions to the Congress for an up or down vote, as we did with base closing commission. It was not permitted. This was not adopted. And as a result, what's to prevent this commission from being just another report that gathers dust?
Well, let's talk about specific solutions first. Both spending and revenues have to be on the table. David said that first off. On the revenue side, the most specific and most near-term thing that we need to do is not extend the so-called Bush tax cuts. Why do I say that? Because they cost something close to $4 trillion over the next decade. Remember that we said at the beginning that we have a $15 trillion gap. $4 trillion would help a lot. We cannot afford them, and we should not be extending them permanently. Now, there is an argument that can be made that they should be maintained in place temporarily, but that's a different argument. Right now, the President of the United States, as well as most members of the Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, are trying to extend them, for the most part, permanently. So the first thing we should do is not do that. That is politically motivated. That is not good policy, in my view. Secondly, we do need to take on Social Security. We've already said a lot about that, so I won't go into that further. And I think we do need to take a second bite out of the health care apple. The reform bill that was enacted this summer took a little nick out of the deficit over the next 10 years or over the next 20 years, but it's only a nick. And there are political reasons to suspect that even those provisions may not be maintained. So we should be doing more on the health care front. I don't want to go on too long, but I can come back to that if you're interested.
Bob Bixby, you've been with the Concord Coalition since it started. And coming up with solutions is the raison d'etre for the Concord Coalition. What is your list?
Well, I would start with I agree with Bill. Everything does need to be on the table. If you're if you're starting with on the spending side, we have said a lot about Social Security, but some of the things that we have advocated over the years is a gradual increase in the eligibility age. It's already going up to 67, but it might go up further. May think about increasing the early retirement age, which would be more controversial, but that would be a possibility. I think raising the payroll tax cap is something that would bring more revenue into the system, and adjusting benefits on a progressive basis is something Concord has always advocated. On the tax side, we need to look at so-called tax expenditures. There's a whole bunch of $1 trillion worth on an annual basis of exemptions, credits, deductions. We really need to go through those and pare them back so that we have a more efficient revenue system. And I would agree with Bell that we need to take another whack at health care. And also, just let me say, defense has got to be on the table. The defense budget has grown dramatically in recent years. And so there is going to have to be some paring back on that front.
May I ask a pointed question then? You do not support continuing all of the tax cuts of the Bush second President George W. Bush administration?
No, we do not. We thought that they were imprudent at the time, but I think that they should not be made permanent. Whether you let them expire now in deference to the economy is a different question, as Bill said.
Like to hear the other two panelists on this?
Let me start by saying I think about the stupidest thing you could do would be to raise taxes in a very weak economy. So I think that's clear. That would have the best thing you could do to avoid this issue of a double dip would be to stop, take tax increases off the table right now. Secondly, I would say that I happen to be in favor of a broader tax base and the lowest possible rates. So I'm sympathetic, not necessarily to just raising revenue, but to use the broader base and lower rates to generate more activity, economic activity, which would generate more revenue. Secondly, on Social Security, I think I would strongly favor price rather than wage indexing of initial benefits, which would keep the level adjusted for inflation, leaving even aside of whether inflation is overestimated or not. Rising through time, it would maintain a strong defined benefit system. The benefit structure of Social Security is highly progressive. It would so that would work. I personally would agree to the idea that it's a good idea to gradually have a small increase in the future in the retirement age, but I personally favor strongly retaining a strong early retirement option. I'm very cognizant as a professor that there are people in physically demanding and dangerous jobs who aren't going to be able to do them very well when they're my age. So I think that's important. On Medicare, I think we really have to rethink Medicare. I think Medicare is very poorly designed to, in general, it's an important program, but it's poorly designed to deal with changes in demography. I think that it's very poorly designed to empower people to control their spending and costs and to be effective. So I think we need to reform Medicare in the sense of giving people the ability to have higher copay, lower monthly payment premiums, to have policies that focus more on catastrophic coverage and the like. So I think those kinds of things, allowing competition into the system, would help reduce costs and help give people more opportunities to incorporate the consumer of the healthcare services on our side to try to help care costs rather than trying to impose it above by the Congress writing all these rules and regs that wind up then getting imposed by special panels that are so unpopular.
And David Walker.
With regard to the so-called Bush tax cuts, I don't believe that any of the income tax rate reductions should be made permanent. I believe a strong case could be made that you should extend temporarily the ones that deal with middle income. I think politically they may end up doing it for upper income. But as a certified public accountant, among other things, a lot of things that people don't realize is that even if you end up going back to the prior marginal tax rates, a lot of people won't pay higher taxes because of something called alternative minimum tax. And so people haven't really focused on that. In addition to that, I think we need to come up with – we need to make the R&D tax credit permanent. I think we need to come up with a long-term solution to the estate tax. I think there should be an estate tax, but with a higher exemption than historically we had and with a lower tax rate than we historically had for a lot of reasons. As far as the early retirement age, I think it needs to go up with an exception for certain occupations where there's heavy manual labor. Both my grandfathers were in that case. One was a mine worker, one was a steel worker. A vast majority of the population is not in that case. You design policy for a vast majority of the population, not a shrinking minority of the population. And then lastly, I think on health care, this last health care bill increased health care costs as a percentage of the economy. It really didn't do much to slow health care costs at all. If there's one thing that would bankrupt the country, it's health care costs. We need to start making some tough decisions on health care costs, on what level of coverage is appropriate, affordable, and sustainable. We need a budget on health care. We've got to move away from fee-for-service. We've got to do real malpractice reform. We got to actually start getting serious rather than playing politics.
I want to ascertain the views of the panel. on tax policy.
That's what I was about to ask.
The tax policy appears to be a point of difference, and so let me just ask if there is, if I have it right. There are three members of the panel who would recommend, at least in part, repealing or allowing to expire the President Bush tax cuts. And Professor Boskin, you would disagree. Am I stating that correctly?
Yes. It's not just that I disagree with that. I think that there's a lot of the talk sounds reasonable. Well, we have to have both spending and revenues, et cetera. But the higher our taxes go, and David, I'm sorry, the harm done from higher tax rates, which every student in introductory economics learns, goes up with the square of the marginal rate. Doubling the rates quadruples the harm. So the worst thing you can do is have high rates. So I think it's extremely important that we keep tax rates as low as possible. And I think I have a strong disagreement with my colleagues about the propriety of getting a large part of this on the tax side. I think that's really that I think would do very serious damage to the economy. And if you want to make these comparisons to the Europeans, if you want to have our standard of living 30% lower, which is what Europe has, and a large part of that, most studies show, traces to their much higher taxes and spending and welfare payments, then I think you're going to wind up generating, the denominator is going to be a problem in your calculation. The GDP is going to be a lot smaller. So your deficit and debt problem isn't going to go away because you're going to harm the economy.
Bell Sawhill?
I think it's interesting to make this comparison to other countries. Other countries do have higher overall tax burdens than the United States, no question. But here's the interesting thing that most people don't know. Europeans rely much less heavily on income taxes than we do. They tax consumption. They do it with a value-added tax, which is essentially a sales tax. That discourages consumption, encourages saving, and encourages growth. I believe that it would be a good idea in the United States if we moved in that direction. We could even reduce the marginal tax rates that Michael doesn't like. I don't like them either. They are bad for the economy. I agree with him on that. But there are many ways to raise revenues that don't affect income tax rates, broadening the base, getting rid of the exemptions and deductions, taxing consumption, taxing energy. We have a problem with climate change. We talked at the beginning about what are the big problems facing this country. I would say top of my list is nuclear proliferation, and second on the list, because it's an equally existential challenge, is climate change, and third is these long-term fiscal problems we're leaving to our children.
Let me ask you to pause a moment and give Mike Boskin 10 seconds to respond. Then I want David Walker, and we need to move.
I think it's important. There have been a lot of economic studies in this. I know most of you won't read the American Economic Review, but the studies reveal that the size of government has the largest impact on living standards. The structure of taxes are important. There are many studies done by professors at Stanford and Berkeley, for example, that show a broader base, lower rate consumption tax can get you, can improve things relative to high income tax rates, but they can't possibly make up anything like that 30% differential. They're more like 6 or 7%. So I think it's very important to have those two things undermined. Those are not perfect substitutes. Better for any given level of spending. For the economy, there are also societal values and issues that are involved. To collect it on the broadest base and lower rate as neutral as possible with respect to saving and investment. But the worst thing you can do is have a much larger government share of the economy and crowd out the private sector.
David Walker.
Let me get to the bottom line. At September 30, 2009, this country was in a $62 trillion financial hole when you count liabilities and off-balance sheet obligations. That's over $200,000 per person, over $500,000 per household, and median household income is $50,000. The problem is primarily a spending problem. In my view, it's 2 to 3 to 1 a spending problem, but you're not going to close that $62 trillion hole in a way that can preserve the social safety net without some additional revenues. There's a new four-letter word in Washington. It's called math.
And Bob Bixby, then we're going to go to questions directly from the audience.
Well, just very quickly, Dave mentioned at the beginning that we've tended to, or maybe it was you in your opening, that we tended to spend at about 21% of GDP, tax at about 18% of GDP. If we could keep spending at about 21% of GDP, you could do that. But with the aging of the population, the demographics, inevitably, even with reform, it's going to go up. And so I think revenues are going to have to go up as well from their past average of 18% of GDP. I just don't think you can do it otherwise.
Our panelists are David Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States, Isabel Sawhill, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, Michael Boskin, Stanford University Economics Professor and Hoover Institution Senior Fellow, Robert Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. And you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today's subject is the federal budget deficit ramifications and solutions. I'm Tom Campbell, the moderator. We go to questions from the audience, and there's several categories, one of which is, what is the role of underfunded pensions in this difficulty? I know, for example, I saw just 2 days ago, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, is going to be bailed out by the state of Pennsylvania in their pension obligations. As we see Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation possibly not being solvent, how does the pension underfunding add to this, or is it a relevant consideration? David Walker.
Well, first, the federal government has several trillion dollars worth of unfunded civilian and military pensions, but they're on the balance sheet. You see them, we record them as a liability. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which I used to head, is underwater a significant amount. It's got a lot more liabilities than it has assets. And state governments alone have about $3 trillion in underfunded pension and retiree health obligations. And so this is a huge issue. There are a lot of legacy costs, many of which are off the balance sheet, that don't get adequately focused on in budgets. Both at the federal and state and local levels, budgets are cash basis. And these are going to be a huge problem in the future because of demographics and rising health care costs. And we need to start dealing with them now so that we can get the power of compounding working for us rather than against us. Because the longer you wait, the tougher it's going to be, the bigger the change is going to have to be, and the greater chance you're going to have a crisis.
A number of the questions deal with the social safety net. And I think Michael Boskin spoke to this already, but I'd be interested in elaboration. Certainly the audience would. Are we proposing things that will jeopardize the social safety net for the most needy?
I don't think we are at all. I think it's important to maintain a humane, cost-effective, and target-effective social safety net. But I think the federal government and state and local governments have decided they're going to do too many things, and as a result, number one, won't be able to afford them, and number two, aren't doing many of them nearly as well as they should. And I think we really have to restructure these programs. We have to target on what's necessary, and we have to have a sense of what is reasonable. We have to phase these reforms in gradually so people have time to plan for them themselves. Somebody who's 30 years old now, who will be retiring several decades in the future, should have a better idea of what that's going to look like. And we should not force people who are already retired or near retirement to bear any big change. But we shouldn't have systems in place that promise Bill Gates' children large increases in Social Security benefits from where they are today.
Would your thinking apply to a means test on Medicare as well?
I think it's important that there be a variety of subsidies that are phased out as income rises. And I think that's probably true in a variety of places, including the health reform and in Medicare. They should be reduced. The focus should be on catastrophic expenses and on people being able to have a wide range of choices, buying a premium where they spent less per month, had higher co-payments and a catastrophic coverage for large expenses, rather than the government for the indefinite future promising people who aren't born yet 75 or 100 years from now that no matter how rapidly healthcare costs go up relative to the economy, no matter what happens in the world, that we're going to pay everything for them no matter what.
And no matter what their income level is. Yeah. David Walker.
We've overpromised in healthcare, and we're going to have to rationalize the promise. But I bet most people in this room don't realize that Medicare is actually three programs. Part A, hospital insurance funded with a payroll tax. Part B, supplemental medical insurance funded with a premium and general revenues. And Part D, prescription drugs funded with a premium and general revenues. Guess what? Part B and D are voluntary. You don't have to sign up for them. But vast majority of people do. Why? Because on average, there's a 75% subsidy irrespective of your income. In fact, billionaires get a 75% subsidy to voluntarily sign up for Medicare Part D, and they get a guaranteed 20% minimum subsidy for Part B. That makes no sense.
A number of questions deal with our defense budget. And we've addressed before a couple of aspects, but the specifics, given the United States military commitments around the world, should we be considering reducing the role, as the questioner puts it, of a world policeman as part of our budget solution? I'm looking to...
I would start...
It looks like I'm looking to Bob Bixby.
Go ahead. Well, I think that there is a number of things. Yes, the fundamental mission is going to determine what happens after that. So I think that, and that determines what your force structure is going to look like. We've been adding to the force structure. It determines what sort of weapon systems you buy. And there have been some procurement reforms that have been proposed that I think are a good thing. But a lot of the costs are personnel costs and even the health care costs. And so it's the growing cost in the Pentagon is reflective in some senses of the of what's driving the rest of the budget. But it's also, I mean, I think that you have to look primarily at the role and scaling back that role. And as the war costs wind down, the defense budget will not grow as rapidly as some of the other parts of the budget. But there are big savings that can be had there.
Specific question or two on Secretary Gates's proposals. So turning to David Walker next, perhaps you might address some of those. Then Bell and Michael.
Well, I was Comptroller General of the United States for almost 10 years and ex officio member on the Defense Business Board, and I can tell you that there's a tremendous amount of waste in defense. We have a lot of weapon systems that are based on past threats rather than future threats. The Defense Department, believe it or not, is not even allowed to consider cost in determining what weapon systems that it wants. As a result, it ends up buying a lot of things or putting a lot of things in the pipeline that people want, but we can't afford and sustain. Our acquisition and contracting system has fundamental flaws in it that result in tens of billions of waste every year. Our all-volunteer force is incredibly expensive and probably not sustainable over time. Healthcare costs are out of control and have to come into control. We have way too much of a presence overseas, if you will, with regard to physical facilities and plant. So there's plenty of room to be able to save money in defense without compromising the national security of the United States. At the same point in time, we do too much, and others do too little, and that has to change.
Do you generally support Secretary Gates's proposals to the extent that you're familiar with them?
Yeah, I think most of his proposals I support, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for taking it on. Frankly, the Pentagon would be 50% more productive. This is an unaudited assertion. If it was 25% smaller, it is a bloated bureaucracy.
Bell Sohill, and then Michael Boskin.
I give Secretary Gates high marks for what he's tried to do. The problem is in Congress. The problem is it's very difficult to cut back weapon systems. I also think this is a matter of David's favorite four-letter word, M-A-T-H. The defense budget is only 20% of the entire budget. We could maybe save between $150 and $200 billion if we got out of Iraq and Afghanistan entirely, and we could maybe add another $50 billion out of scrubbing the overall budget. But there aren't huge savings there, and most of the projections of the long-term deficits that we've talked about at the beginning don't include these extra costs for the war. So we should be, I think, very tough on scrubbing the defense budget, but not unrealistic about what kind of savings are there.
A large number. I'm sorry, I forgot. Michael, please.
Yeah, I have a somewhat different perspective. First of all, I'm very strongly supportive of what Secretary Gates is doing. For those of you who aren't aware of it, he's instituting a wider range of procurement and force sizing and weapons development system, integration, et cetera, across the services to try to reduce costs and make the force structure and the procurement and the weaponry more relevant to what our perceived as our current and future threats rather than our past threats, which I think is desirable. But I do want to say, of all the responsibilities of the federal government, and we here are debating how big or medium or small it ought to be and how much it should be doing on this, that, and the other thing, the single most important is to keep us safe, is our national security and our safety. We can argue about different episodes where one or more of us might think we did things right or wrong, but the fact of the matter is I think you start with a defense budget that's designed to be sufficient to do that. You're sure you want to wring all the savings you can out of consistent with that, but I don't think we should be budgeting for our national security based on trying to save a few bucks here and there if it would do any measurable harm to our national security. So I think it's important that this be done relevant to the proper strategy, and then hopefully our elected leaders will figure out the right things to do. With respect to the rest of the world, I do agree the rest of the world has free-ridden on us a bit. The Europeans loved it when we were protecting them against a Russian invasion across the North German plain, and we had massive force deployments over there. We've been scaling those back. But ask yourself, what would go on if we really needed somewhere? Who could have done what was done in Kosovo? The Europeans couldn't. The average age of many of their military is over 50. They don't have a serious fighting force, most of them. It's very, very tiny. So I just want to remind you that, again, without putting a pro or con on any episode we've had recently or surge this or deployment that or, you know, Bob Woodward's book and all that sort of stuff, let's just say that it's important to start by what we really need and what our national security is.
We have 5 minutes left and four panelists, so that gives me the opportunity now to put a final question to each of our panelists. It'll be the same one, and it is asked many times in different ways by the audience. And I think I can best summarize it by saying, if you had to include taxes in the solution, what would your proposal be? There are, from the audience, suggestions of a VAT, lifting the cap on the FICA tax to so that more of a higher income person's income is taxed for the Social Security and Medicare. There are suggestions regarding President Obama's. We'll continue the tax cuts, but only if you make under $250,000. There are suggestions on petroleum tax. So the audience has many suggestions. I'd like to know the panel's answer to this question. If you had to include taxes in the answer, and I recognize at least one panelist says it's not the right thing to do at the moment, where would you go? And I'll start with Bob Bixby.
Well, I think I outline my preferred list. Oh, maybe I didn't. I think that a VAT, a VAT tax, some sort of consumption tax would be the way that I would go to bring in more revenues in a cost-efficient way. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons that we need to do that is I agree with Michael that we do need to start cutting back on the deficits before the long term. And one of the reasons is the interest costs are going to kill us by 10 years. We're going to go from about $200 billion now to about $1 trillion by the end of the decade. So we do need to move quickly. It's going to take a while to phase in some of the long-term spending things that we've talked about. That's one of the reasons I think revenue should be on the table. And a VAT tax would be the way to go, I guess.
Thank you. Bell Sahel.
I like a VAT as well, but I think at the top of my list, since if I'm only allowed to have one thing, is going to be a tax on energy. A carbon tax would be ideal. It would encourage alternative fuels and reduce consumption, and it's a much more efficient way to get the new clean technologies and the new alternative fuels that we need, as well as to change all of our lifestyles in a good direction than it is through regulation or through various kinds of ad hoc subsidies that go through the federal budget.
Michael, I strongly oppose a value-added tax if it is used to finance government spending. If it was used to replace the corporate and personal tax, that would be a sensible tax reform. This has been the major way the Europeans have financed their much larger government, and I think about the worst legacy we could do to resolve our fiscal situation would be to turn the United States into a European-style social welfare state financed by a VAT. So I'm against it, except in limited circumstances. I wouldn't be very happy about it, but if I had to come up with some additional revenue after we had scrubbed the short, medium, and long-term budget as best as could be done, I would look to what exemptions and deductions could be pared back.
I think you have to decide what percentage of the economy do you want to raise in revenues. You've got to constrain spending. You don't want to have an open spigot that potentially could happen with a VAT. You need to have tough statutory budget controls to constrain spending and do some of the things we've talked about. My personal view is I would prefer to have a progressive consumption tax in lieu of the income tax, in lieu of the payroll tax. That's a bridge too far. So I think realistically where we'll go is a broader base for income taxation to keep marginal rates as low as possible on the individual side, a broader base for corporate taxation and more comparability for global taxation with a lower rate, a dramatically lower marginal rate for lots of economic and competitiveness reasons, a higher cap on taxable wage-based cap for Social Security but not an elimination. We need some type of energy tax and probably some type of a progressive consumption tax, possibly a VAT, with tough statutory budget controls and other reforms, probably earmarked for health care.
I've come now to the end of our program. I want to thank our panelists for their expertise and their candor and their willingness to share both with us. You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our subject has been the nation's budget deficit. Our panel has been David M. Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States, Isabel V. Sawhill, Senior Fellow at Brookings Institution, Michael Boskin, Stanford University Economics Professor and Hoover Institution Senior Fellow, and Robert L. Bixby, Executive Director of the Concord Coalition. We also thank our audiences both here in San Francisco and on radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Charles and Louise Travers series on ethics and accountability, and it's been held in association with the Shorenstein Program in Politics, Policy, and Values at the University of California at Berkeley. We also want to thank the Concord Coalition and its members for their help in making this program possible. I'm Tom Campbell, visiting professor of economics and law at Chapman University, professor of business on leave from the Haas School of Business, University of California, Berkeley. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.